This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Welcome to Investing Insights. I'm your host, Ivana Hampton. The tech bubble appeared to resemble another era. However, many managers declared then that this time is different, until it wasn't. Morningstar Research Services Senior Manager Research Analyst Jack Shannon is joining Investing Insights. Jack has written about how 2020 and 2021 were a virtual repeat of the dot-com bubble. So, Jack, why did you decide to compare these two investing periods?
Yeah. So in my everyday role here at Morningstar, I talk with fund managers, get sort of annual updates from them just to see what they're doing with their portfolio and sort of explaining maybe the past year's moves within their portfolio. And so what I had begun to hear through 2020 and then really into 2021 was, especially among growth managers, like you'd see them start buying stocks that maybe they usually didn't buy. You'd see them buying, you know, these younger, unprofitable companies where typically they'll tell you, like, I only want to buy entrenched businesses with entrenched competitive advantages, yada, yada, yada. And so you'd ask them about, like, well, why are you sort of repositioning a little bit? And I would always sort of frame it as, like, the skeptic could say this is sort of a repeat of the tech bubble where things are starting to get a little inflated. And they'd always tell me, well, you know, this is very different than the tech bubble. You know, this time these tech companies are like producing a lot of cash flow. You know, they're profitable. This is not like the, you know, the dot-com bubble where any company with a dot-com in their name would then, you know, see this big valuation jump. And so I'd always hear this from managers and I sort of took it at, you know, sort of the trust but verify sort of stance where it's like, oh, okay, interesting. But at some point I'm going to get around to like actually verifying this. And so then after the 2022 market decline, where especially that basket of stocks did really, really poorly, I decided to systematically look at it to see just how similar the two periods were. And it turns out they were sort of strikingly similar.
All right. So you've written that it's dangerous to quote, when the market chases companies pursuing growth at any cost. Can you share a couple examples from the recent mania?
Yeah, I think the most obvious examples are like the COVID beneficiary sort of stocks. These are the companies that during, you know, the sort of the COVID policies, you know, benefited greatly. So like think of like Carvana, which is a online sort of website where you can buy and sell used cars. That's one where you saw the revenue go from, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but revenue grew about three times between the end of 2019 and the end of 2021. Stock price went up like 5x. And plenty of managers I covered, you know, I talked to them about that and they'd say, well, this is fundamentally, you know, changing the car buying industry where it's like, yes, it pulled forward some demand. But we think going forward, people are not going to be going onto the, you know, the showroom floors. They're not going to be walking on the parking lots to buy new cars. They're going to go online. And that was sort of always the sort of the defense. And when you'd ask them about the valuation and say, hey, you know, it seems like mostly just some sort of, you know, I guess unique circumstances around the period, they say, we think this is a sort of a new phenomenon that will persist going forward. So like Carvana was one where you saw a lot of managers come in after the stock had sort of hit its peak. So I think like T. Rowe Price, blue chip growth is one where they owned like 1.2% of their portfolio in Carvana, and then subsequently Carvana dropped 90%. So you see some managers who we really respect and actually have very high ratings on still sort of get sucked into sort of that narrative of the day. And it's sort of hard, I think, for most people to sort of filter through that noise. There are other, you know, examples like that, like DoorDash is another one where we didn't get to eat in restaurants for like a year, so people were ordering in. You know, DoorDash's revenues look great for a while because, you know, people are obviously not going to restaurants. And so you saw a bunch of, you know, again, managers that we have high ratings on, you know, build up pretty significant stakes in that company. And again, subsequently sort of felt the burn when, you know, that growth didn't continue.
So why do you think active fund managers snapped up these growth stocks while their valuations were skyrocketing?
Yeah, I think they're like everybody else, they're prone to the same, you know, biases me and you are, where it's like, hey, this seems to be working. You know, this basket of stocks is doing well. You know, you listen to the narrative that's out there and you say to yourself, well, this makes sense. Maybe I should buy it. And there's also, I think, you know, no one will ever admit to it, but I do think there is some sort of looking over the shoulder-ism about it, where if you're an active manager, you're being paid to generate relative performance. So you want to beat your peers and you want to beat the index. So if your peers are buying this basket of stocks that's doing well, and the index, and because of that, the index then starts to take on more exposure to that same sort of basket of stocks, you're sort of incentivized to do so as well. Because if you don't do it and the trend continues, you look like you're lagging everybody. You get questions from clients saying like, hey, how did you miss this big market move? I thought you were supposed to be the person with foresight here. And then if you do it, there's not too much downside. I mean, there is a downside in that you'll lose capital, but at the same time, the index is going to go down too, and so are your peers. So there is sort of an asymmetric incentive structure there that, again, no one really ever admit to it, but I do think that does come into play.
Well, I think it's interesting that you brought that up, and I hope the listeners are taking note of that. How can individual investors spot a bubble in the funds, you know, either that they own or they're thinking about buying?
Certainly easier to do in hindsight than it is at the moment. I mean, I'm obviously sitting here being the hindsight genius, but it's very hard at the time. I think what like this paper showed was there are some things that like are just sort of unsustainable. So, you know, buying very, you know, what I focused on was never profitable companies. So not only companies that are unprofitable at the time, but they had never turned a profit. And then of that basket, the ones that were trading at very high multiples. So something I do in my sort of everyday due diligence when I'm, you know, monitoring my coverage list is I run an analysis that just tracks how much of the portfolio is in these sort of never profitable businesses. And it varies depending on what category of investment it is. You know, like small growth funds are going to naturally have more than large growth funds. But one thing you can do there is, and we'll probably talk about it in the performance section, is the more exposure you have to that sort of basket of never profitable companies, it's certainly the more risky that fund is going to be. And especially in the times where, you know, valuations start to get high, the more and more risky they get. And that's real where you can get burned. It's an easy screen to run, I guess. Just look at a portfolio and see which ones are profitable and not. And that could hopefully help avoid some future pain.
All right. So talk about the damage from the tech bubble bursting. Mm-hmm. What did you see?
Yeah. So very similar story between the tech bubble and then what we could just call the COVID bubble, I guess. But what we saw was the more unprofitable, never profitable businesses owned by a portfolio, the worse the fund did in sort of the subsequent crash. I think the period for the tech bubble is like maybe March 2000 to March 2001. The Russell 1000 growth, so I was looking at growth funds, large growth funds. Russell 1000 growth fell 42%. And if every fund in the category that did not own any never profitable companies beat the index, every single one of them did. The ones that did the worst, you know, it was like Barron Opportunity, a few others that lost more than 50%, but they had more than 50% of their portfolio in these sort of companies. And then again, we saw the same thing with sort of the COVID era, where, you know, it's not a pure linear trend, but it's pretty strong correlation between how much of these sort of junkier high valuation companies you own and the worst performance you saw.
So you did all this research. Were there any surprises when you compared the tech bubble to the dot-com bubble?
I was surprised at how similar they were. I went in with the hunch that like they were going to be fairly similar because maybe the natural skeptic in me. But I was surprised that like I guess I went into it thinking markets are efficient. You know, there's market memory. People learn from past mistakes and there should be, I guess, some sort of memory that sticks in you, where there's, you know, senior people at your firm or someone who would say, hey, you know, this reminds me of this scenario or this reminds me of this era. So I expected it to be a similar phenomenon, but a little more muted. But it ended up being like very, very similar. And so that's, I mean, to me, it sort of said that, you know, maybe markets aren't as efficient as we like to sort of popularly think they are. And maybe that, you know, maybe every new generation of sort of market participants, whether it's traders, portfolio managers, analysts, maybe they are sort of doomed to have to learn the same lessons over and over again that their, you know, their predecessors had to learn. That's sort of the, I guess, the, maybe the pessimistic view of it. But I think there is some truth to it.
Well, let's hope that the next generation learns from this generation.
I hope so. But I mean, yeah, you see it repeat through history. So it you know, some people are better at it than others. And I've actually talked to, you know, different asset management firms about how they try to, because they'll acknowledge that is a problem. You know, when you bring new people in, you know, especially younger analysts, you know, today who maybe, you know, they graduated college after the financial crisis. And so they've only known really one market environment. Firms are actually tackling, like, how do we sort of inform younger analysts about history, and how do we sort of ingrain in them that, like, today's not the only, you know, not the only world, and that things have happened in the past and could happen again.
History lessons.
Yeah, I think they're good.
So right now we're in a rising interest rate environment. How did the interest rate environment during the tech bubble and the dot-com bubble play a role in those?
Yeah, so that's a interesting angle because back in the tech bubble, dot-com bubble era, rates were, you know, normal. They were like the 10-year treasury was about 5-6% yield, whereas during this sort of COVID bubble, it was, you know, rates were below 1%. The 10-year rate was below 1%. And so why that matters is because the way interest rates affect valuations is through a discount rate. So long story short, you know, you think about a company, you project its earnings out into the future. The higher the discount rate is, the less value those future earnings are, and so the less valuable that company is today. So there is sort of an argument to be made that maybe the COVID sort of bubble participants weren't as bad as the tech bubble, because the tech bubble people were having these huge valuations with high interest rates, which makes it sort of even maybe a bit crazier than when it's super low interest rates, you can, you know, mentally sort of, you know, talk yourself into the valuation making sense. But that gets into like the idea of, you know, interest rates don't stay the same forever. Interest rates are always changing. So if you're buying a stock based on a valuation that's based on just the current interest rate, and that valuation could change steeply if interest rates go up, maybe you're not holding the right company to begin with. And maybe, you know, everyone sort of does sensitivity analysis, which is just like, hey, if we change this input, how much does our valuation change? And I wonder how much of that was actually done with interest rates for this sort of latest round of stocks. Because you talk to managers who got burned by it, and a lot of them say, well, you know, I got burned because rates went up. I didn't get burned because my thesis was wrong. I still think this is a great company. I still think it's got potential to grow and become an industry leader in 5 to 10 years. But the market sold it off because of the rates and because of the valuation hit. But I still think I might be right, which is a fun conversation. And they will be right about some of them. They will.
All right. So you just have to keep a record and come back in 5 to 10 years. Do you have anything else to add from your research?
Like I said, there's sort of a pessimistic sort of takeaway, which would be that we're doomed to repeat things. or there's a sort of an optimistic way, which is just, you know, if you know that this sort of thing is a cycle, and you might have, you know, some leading indicators. And I think one of the leading indicators could be how much sort of activity there is by fund managers in buying these sort of, you know, junkier high valuation companies. I think if you can see that ahead of time, you can, you know, maybe prepare yourself and at least avoid some funds that have the potential to really blow up, which we saw in both periods.
All right. Well, thank you, Jack, for explaining why this time it was not different.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Subscribe to Morningstar's YouTube channel to see new videos about investment ideas. You can hear market trends and analyst insights from Morningstar on your Alexa devices. Say, play Morningstar. Thanks to senior video producer Jake Vankerson. And thank you for tuning in to Investing Insights. I'm Ivana Hampton, a senior multimedia editor here at Morningstar. Take care.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. While this guest may license or offer products and services of Morningstar and its affiliates, unless otherwise stated, he or she is not affiliated with Morningstar and its affiliates. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.